It was a great pleasure to catch up with Mark Connolly for the latest in my series of nostalgia interviews. Now, Mark is a professor of modern British military history at the University of Kent, but we share a huge influence, as you'll see in the course of the interview, with Christmas and radio. Now, we talk about Mark's background. His father is a London cab driver. We find out about his ancestry. He was the first in his family to go to university. We find out about going to the Imperial War Museum and the Tower of London when he was young. A love of Frank Sinatra through his parents. We talk about Slade's Merry Christmas, everybody. Neil Diamond and Spandau Ballet. About encountering, get this, Chesney Hawks on a plane. And then we have a geeky conversation about Romy and Michelle's high school reunion, which I think is a guilty pleasure for both of us. We learn what inspired Mark, who was the only pupil to take O-level religious education at his school, to enter academia. We find out that he is still in touch with his O and A-level history teacher. He was the head of the History Society at university. He's a devotee of West Ham Football Club. And we share our love of radio. In particular, Mark talks about his love of comedy shows like the News Headlines. Why he is a fan of the jingles that were played on LBC. Why he is misty-eyed for Desmond Carrington. And we talk about Not Off, Pick of the Pops and Alan Fluff Freeman. Mark recalls growing up in the 1970s during the doom and gloom of the winter of discontent. We talk about his happy memories of his teenage years, how his Crohn's disease has taught him various lessons, how he is nostalgic for wallowing in solipsistic moments of teenage misery, for example, in the form of the music of the Smiths. It was such a pleasure to catch up with Mark Connolly. Mark is the latest guest in my series of nostalgia interviews. My name is Chris Deasy. Well, it's an absolute pleasure to have Mark Connolly with me here today. And of course, Mark, we've met in a number of capacities over the years. We have a shared interest in Christmas.
We do indeed.
And you'll be delighted to know that my students adore your book that came out in 2000 and the one that came out a few years later as well. And it was actually through your work on Christmas that helped me both with my own Christmas project and the nostalgia work that I'm doing.
Lovely.
At the moment. So that's terrific. I know we have a shared interest in radio.
Yeah, absolutely.
Which may come up in the conversation, but we shall see. But tell me a bit, Mark, about your background. When and where you were born.
Right, I grew up in the London suburb of Newbury Park, North East London, very typical kind of mongrel East Ender. My mum's German, she came to the East End after the Second World War. Basically, her father had been killed in the war, and my grandmother married a British serviceman, as a lot of German women did, and so he came home with his ready-made daughter. And my dad's from a really weird mix of Irish, that hence the surname Connolly, Protestant Irishman, and also on his mum's side Russian Jews, who were in Whitechapel, and he grew up in Bethnal Green. So that's a bit about my family history. And with that obviously inspired my own love of history, I think.
Well, I was going to ask whether you then had the urge to go back, and it sounds like you have done, explore your family ancestry.
Yes, I mean, the trails run out for me quite quickly on my dad's mum's side, you know, because they came out in a pogrom from the Ukraine in the 1870s, as far as we can work out. My mum's family all seem to have been Westphalians, some of them actually living just over the border in the Netherlands, from what I can see. And it's I think, just gives you a sense of the wonder of the past, actually, and the accidents that lead someone to be where they are.
Absolutely, because my own grandparents met in the Second World War, and so it was. And if they hadn't met in Newquay, Cornwall, my grandmother was in the West, my grandfather in the RAF. Obviously, I wouldn't be here today. But it was very striking because they both came from villages, one in Cardiff, one in Worcester, and through that meeting, they were both engaged to other people. Obviously, history was changed. But were you aware of this from a young age, or did you follow, did you trace your ancestry when you were grown up, and even studying history?
I was aware of it from quite a young age, I suppose because of my mum's German background and my dad's Jewish side, it meant that in dietary terms, although we were never kosher, you know, a lot of things that we ate were not what the kids that I went to school with had. I mean, particularly at breakfast, they didn't understand why I would eat things like chopped herring and beef in a beetroot, so they couldn't get any of these weird things, and smoked salmon. I mean, in the 1970s. You know, Scots, I suppose, and richer people, as it were, had smoked salmon, and people of Jewish background ate smoked salmon, and not many others. So it could sort of, the dietary differences, as much as anything else, sort of showed that there was a sort of different family culture, and that kept me going in history. And then probably about the age of 5 or 6, as a lot of people know me and I've bored them with, I discovered Ladybird history books. And oh my goodness, Ladybird history books were just everything to me. That the marriage of picture and text, you know, I still find incredibly powerful. Knights in armour. There are a lot of knights in armour in Ladybird history books, and that really grabbed my imagination as a kid.
Yeah, because it's funny, what is the prompt? Because I remember doing a history project in school, and I had to talk about my grandparents' experiences of the Second World War. And I remember that was very much linked in with Dame Vera Lynn, who of course is still going at 101. Yeah. And so I was able to hear the music of Dame Vera Lynn, and I even to this day get very upset at hearing the White Cliffs of Dover. And of course now I live not far from the White Cliffs of Dover. So that's all sort of come together, and I always associate that with my grandparents. But it's interesting, that link, that connection between the personal, the autobiographical, and then the academic study. Yeah. And indeed, I think this whole podcast series is clearly a fusion of all those interests. But that's really fascinating. What did your parents do?
My dad is a London cabbie, and that's what I was sort of part of a dynasty of, because my two uncles and my brother are all London cabbies. And my mum was a very sort of traditional, what we might call upper end of the work. Class, lower middle class, suburban East London housewife, insofar as she'd had various kind of like shop jobs before she got married and before me and my brother were born. But then she was a mum, you know, and a housewife probably till me and my brother were about the age of 8. Then she started to get some part-time jobs in things like Boots and, you know, W.H. Smith's, and kind of went back a little bit into the working world. But it was a very traditional sort of mum and dad kind of background, in which there were, you know, dad roles and mum roles. It was a world of the 1970s.
Yeah. So in terms of your university career, were you first generation university?
Yes, I was the first one to go to university. I mean, I suppose, again, coming from that migrant side, I always remember particularly my great grandmother, who died when she was 101, and so remembered, again, what was a great thing, she remembered very clearly the autumn of 1888. She lived in Whitechapel, so she remembered the autumn of Jack the Ripper. She was a school child. That was fascinating. And of course, she remembered being bundled in from school at the end of the day, not so much because they were scared, you know, that the Ripper might get them, but the rumour was that he was Jewish, and her father was very worried that there might be attacks on their tenement block, so he would tape up like the kind of letterbox and stuff. So she had very clear memories of that. But anyway, she was obsessed with the idea. The term that she always seemed to talk about was winning scholarships. So education was everything. You had to. So there's a big emphasis on education, both from my mum and dad as well. Not in any kind of pressurised, you know, you must study, sit there with like a miner's lamp and work all night long. But that education was really important and was to be revered. And I wasn't actually particularly good at much apart from history and English. I really liked those. And in some ways, you could say it was a damning indictment of the British school system that I went into school and I don't ever remember being confident with numbers, but liking history and reading things. And I left all those years later, still not confident in numbers, but a bit better at history and reading things, you know. So they never quite got the number problem out of me. But as I said, there was a sense in which education was very much revered as your ticket to do what ever you wanted in life, really.
And certainly, I know my grandfather would have loved to have gone. I think he would have thrived at university, but he was in the Second World War. Yeah. And I think, therefore, he was so proud of my sister and I because we were the first in our family to go to university.
Yeah, yeah.
But you're absolutely right. I think that when you're sort of growing up, I mean, I went to an all very arts-based university in the University of Wales, and, you know, we all had a wonderful time, but we all went there to do, whether it was history or, in my case, theology or English, but, you know, so many of us came away feeling that we were almost like innumerate.
Yes. I do remember I'd have very good maths teacher when I was resitting what was then CSE. I'd been working for CSE maths, you know, and that had just been scrapped for this new GCSE thing. So I was trying to sort of...
I was the second year GCSE.
Right, okay, yeah. I was trying to get this new qualification. And I still mucked it up, but I got a very good maths teacher. I remember The one thing she taught me how to do, simultaneous equations, which had terrified me. And I didn't care. I said to her, look, I know I've mucked it all up again, but I could do the equations. And that felt like such a breakthrough that I'd finally understood the principle. You know, and that thing, and I think it's Stephen Fry that talks about it in Moab Is My Washpot, of realizing that the equal sign is like a balance. You know, to me, it's equals was leading you to make something, and where was your mind get meant to go? So it equals that, equaling your being, and I'm making a sort of set of scales gesture here, you know, the balancing, it balances that was like a massive breakthrough for me.
But I always find that even when I'm writing a book, or when I was a student writing essays, there was a sense in which I was very aware of, as you say, balance, sort of making sure that the paragraphs were sort of equally balanced. You know, if you had one really long paragraph, one short one, then you needed to recalibrate them. And I sort of think that although I never thrived at maths, I think that there are lots of skills about, as you say, making things come together, making things balance. Maybe our politicians could learn a few lessons from that. I'm not going to mention Brexit. But it is interesting, isn't it, how sometimes we, in our own comfort zones, we're able to thrive. I mean, I've always been, you know, good at paying bills or understanding bills, etc. But you know, the thought of studying maths, kind of, I need the context within which that operates. Yeah, so I think I naturally gravitate towards humanities disciplines. But it's sort of like I've almost assimilated all the sort of things at school, science and humanities, and somehow come to something where I feel I understand, I'm on the right sort of path, but it certainly wouldn't be right for everyone else. Whereas at least one of my children is really good at maths. And I'm thinking, well, I'm so pleased for her, but it's like she's able to do things at the age of 5 or 6 that I certainly wasn't able to do, even maybe a few years later than that. What about earliest memories? How far can you go back?
Oh, gosh. I suppose, and it's connected with Christmas, I have a memory. Both me and my brother were born in Barts Hospital in the city of London. And my mum had been quite ill with blood pressure during her second pregnancy, and I think she had been taken into hospital. My brother was born in the February, and I think she was taken into hospital and perhaps on and off in about the January time. And I distinctly remember it was a very cold winter, and they have big fountain kind of ponds in the courtyard at Barts Hospital, and seeing the huge goldfish under the ice. I can remember that and finding that amazing, because they weren't moving much, you know, very kind of dopey midwinter things. But that sticks with me. And going into the beautiful little church, which is there, of St. Bartholomew the Less, and it having its crib and Christmas tree still up. And I think they must have left up, because my brother's born on Candlemas Day. And I think they did the full traditional thing, you know, of leaving it till Candlemas. Because my memory, whether it's a false one or not, is that we went in there a lot, and the tree always seemed to be there. And then the next thing I know, there was my baby brother there. So I would have been, about 2.5 years difference. And I think that's what, 2.5, 3. So I would have been round about that age. That's a very distinct early memory.
And so the fact that you ended up studying Christmas, probably, in some ways, it'd be nice to trace that back.
Yes, But I think it is. And obviously, it's then connected with the Ladybird Book of Christmas Customs, which was a great one of my ones, which I loved. And I'm sure it's in there. Was it Shelley in one of his poems who said something like, "We are a portion of everything we've ever loved," something like that. And I kind of feel that perhaps there's a variant on that. All the little scraps that I've picked up over the years have remained there, and I've just been working through a scrapbook ever since.
Oh, absolutely. The way that we all process things. In the case of my own work, it was this sense that, particularly because we're recording this in December, and I could never work out what Christmas was. It was a different thing for each constituency. It's either very religious or it's not religious. Yes. It's a secular festival of consumption. But I thought, well, Marx talked about a religion of materialism, so why can't Christmas be a religion of consumerism? So, and I think it was working out, you know, and also navigating the ways that different family members would construe Christmas. You know, it's either is about family or it's not about family. It's about money or not about money. The spirit or not about the spirit. And it's a hodgepodge, which that was my conclusion. I knew that all along, but at least I felt good that I'd made an effort with it and found some sources to corroborate that. So I'm very proud. What about things that you enjoyed doing as a child?
Well, because my dad, actually my mum as well, really kind of proud Londoners, and there was a sense in which London was the history of Britain, and Britain obviously was the history of the world. So it was all there. So my dad brought me and my brother up with two things in life: be West Ham supporters, and weeks where West Ham weren't at home, to go with him in the cab, police cab, or the car around London. He would take us to galleries, to museums. So I have distinct memories. And you know, being two lads of a particular type, we adored the Imperial War Museum, wanted to go there, adored HMS Belfast, and loved the Tower of London. You know, a huge castle plonked down in the middle of London. So they are very early memories for me of running around those places and really, yeah, finding that passion for the past, and particularly the square mile of the city of London, you know, the ancient city, that back then, particularly on a Saturday afternoon, was sepulchrally quiet. You know, it really was a Monday to Friday existence. And that thing of being able to walk down lanes, and as I got a little bit older, you know, you start to have a vague sense of, you know, there was someone like Christopher Wren or something like that. Wow, that this, even with all the bombing and all the rest of it, this is the world of that strange, weird past. Yeah, that they're very sort of strong standout memories for me as a youngster, as a little lad.
And again, easy to see how that clearly impacted on your future career. That never left you, indeed, no. Very much defined you.
Absolutely. But when you were young. Absolutely.
I mean, the thing that also very much defined me was music, you know, growing up. That whole thing about, in the playground, definitely, we'd all be sharing what was in the charts, were our favourite records going up or down. Do you have any associations along those sort of lines?
And again, I suppose it's slightly imbibed from parents. They've put into me a big love of Frank Sinatra, the Capitol Years. They were big fans. So albums like Songs for Swinging Lovers, Come Fly With Me. You know, I've never became a fan of New York. I think his voice had gone, you know, but those 50s concept albums. I kind of can hear in my ear. I don't think I was a fan of them age 6 or 7, but when in my late teens I kind of rediscovered Sinatra, and that this was huge for me, and that was from them. But what I do remember from the radio, because we always had the radio on, things like Pilot, Ho 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 It's Magic, you know that is a song of my childhood. Leo Sayer, I can hear very distinctly, and obviously because it is this time of year, all of those Christmas hits. And when I talk to my undergrads now, say I have the vaguest of memories of Slade the first time round, then the second time round when they re-released it, was it 84 or 85? Absolutely, or something. So Christmas hits are big. Music is Neil Diamond, a big part of my
I've seen him at the O2 actually.
I
really saw him on a giant screen, because I was too far away. I went all that way to see him, and I didn't actually see him closer. It was almost like so near, but also very far away.
Yeah, so Sweet Caroline is if I hear that, I will smell overdone Brussels sprouts or overdone cabbage on a Sunday afternoon at lunchtime, and the sound of my dad opening a can of Indcoop's Long Life, the chish of the can, of the Ringpool can being opened. Yeah, so the music, the smells, the wider sounds.
Absolutely, and the associations I have, I can pinpoint particular periods of being in primary school or secondary school or university based on what was in the charts.
Absolutely.
And Bucks Fizz, Making Your Mind, the first record I bought, Eurovision 81. Yeah. But the Christmas songs as well, Human League, Don't You Want Me, that's one of my and even the Winifred School Choir.
Well, you know, I showed my kids a few years back the lovely bit where it's on YouTube, where they're on Tis Was, and I think the Phantom Flam Flower comes out, and some of the kids start almost crying. They're so shocked, and I was wetting myself with laughter. I looked at my two, who must have been about 4 and 7 at the time, and they were nearly crying as well. They couldn't understand why these kids had been sort of assaulted by this. And then thinking, how do you explain the concept of Tis Was to any kid now? But yeah, all of those. And you know, I grew up, I suppose, just as I was entering my teens. Yeah, for my 13th birthday, it only just come out, the album True, Spandau Ballet. Oh, did I ever love Spandau Ballet? And even now, to hear, you know, the overdone ballad that is True or Gold will transport me. But I was very pleased when, you know, years later, getting that on a CD and having it in CD form.
So true, funny how it seems.
Absolutely, yeah. And then that slow, I suppose, melding of music, of moving on again. By the time I was an undergrad, what I really wanted to be was somewhere, and my whole look was based around being really the missing member of the House Martins. You know, that I was a big House Martins fan by that stage, and hearing their albums, and anything by James reminds me of being a first year undergrad as well.
Absolutely, and for me that was very much around during my A-level
right,
year,
yeah.
And Sit Down.
Yeah.
Completely, and of course also one of the greatest songs not to make number one, I think it was Chesney Hawkes, off the top spot.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, the great Chesney Hawkes. Lame claim to fame. I queued up behind him once on a flight to Barcelona. It was years after that big moment.
Oh well, maybe we'll come back later. although of course he might have also said, "You'll never get behind me." It's Mark Connelly, the guy who writes about Christmas and history. He was behind me on that flight, I think, because he was a one-hit wonder.
He really was. And of course, why do I associate him? And again, is it because it's Christmas going around in my head? Rick Astley with his cover version of When I Fall in Love. Yeah. And I sort of have that as a kind of late slushy 80s ballad. And I kind of have Rick Astley, Chesney Hawkes in the same kind of category in my head.
I remember a funny story when I was at university. This is anecdotal, but apparently somebody had heard the Nat King Cole version and said, "Why is this fella singing a cover of a Rick Astley song?" But yeah.
Ah, very good.
But that's one of those Facebook memories that you wouldn't want to share. Absolutely. And that was really funny because very much my dad's, this was 1987, wasn't it?
Yeah,
and
yeah.
My dad obviously knew Nat King Cole from growing up, and I was more of the Rick Astley generation.
Right,
but there was this big thing when it looked, because they released the Nat King Cole version the same week.
That's right.
And it looked at one point as though Nat King Cole might be, I don't think either of them obviously made it to number one. But it looked as though Nat King Cole was going to beat Rick Astley to the Christmas number one.
Yeah,
it was neither of them. Indeed, nor was it, of course, the Pogues.
No, that's right. Yeah, which is one of the
Pet Shop Boys. Of course, was that
Pet Shop Boys? Yeah. I distinctly remember West End Girls coming out, and that seeming a really new departure, actually, but elements of it that struck me then as almost kind of bits of a revival of Gary Numan and the Tubeway. I mean, there was something enough in the technology of the sound, as it were, that really reminded me of some of that early new romantic stuff that I kind of, I suppose, in my mid-teens, being born in 1970, I was probably about 16, 17, when I kind of went back and rediscovered a lot of the early new romantic stuff. Started listening to Flock of Seagulls, things like that. But the interesting thing was, although I don't remember being into it, aged 11 or 12, as soon as I was starting to rehear it, it pinned me back down in that moment.
Yeah, I have this recollection of being in my grandfather's house, and it was Iran was one of them. The photograph Flock of Seagulls, exactly. I don't know anything else about them, really, other than 1982.
Yeah.
And it was in the charts, maybe in the autumn of that year.
Yeah.
But absolutely, very straight. And I think the Beatles had there was a re-release of the Beatles. It was 20 years since. Was it Love Me Do? But so all of that is associated.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's a particular period. And often, of course, you think of mortality, people who are no longer around.
Yeah.
But this was the soundtrack to that era.
Absolutely.
And I can't listen to these songs without associating it with that primary listening experience.
Yeah, and of course anyone, I suppose my age, who was old enough to see Top Gun at the cinema, the sense, I think that was the first time I saw a film where I started to think, has the film been built around the soundtrack? Do you know what I mean? Because it was so integral to it. Take My Breath Away, where he goes off on the motorbike, and every kind of teenage lad's dream to have a motorbike like that, a girlfriend like that,
Well, my regret is that in those days I didn't used to go to the cinema,
right?
And yet I knew all the songs, and I knew they were from these particular films. But in later years I re-explored or explored for the first time these films, and then could see how the soundtrack, which I was very familiar with, slotted in.
Yeah,
and it was interesting then to almost watch these films in later years and think, now I know why people at school were really keen on these, on this music or on this film. But it took me many years with a combination of hindsight, but also a sense that I needed to open up my horizons. Conflation between cinema and soundtrack is a very, actually, indissoluble one, but it was one that I came to perhaps a bit later than my peers.
Well, I think that's what's really fascinates me, you know, about what 90s films, where they're doing the retrospective thing, and it's so crucial, the music's so crucial. I'm thinking of Gross Point Blank, which I adored. You know, they're all 80s vinyl weekender, yes, where they have their reunion. I would have been mid-20s, I think, when that film came out. And it was almost as if it was made by people that age, for people like about my age, because taking back, it would have been sort of mid-80s, about the time when I was coming towards the end of my schooling. And of course, Romy and Michelle's high school reunion, where she does the soundtrack, where they've managed to squeeze that XJS out of their chum who's lent it to them. They're going to ride it back to their old school. And just loving that in my mid-20s, having a glimpse back at being a teenager.
Well, I'm glad you've admitted to that, because that's one of the guiltiest of guilty pleasures.
Well, Romy and Michelle's high school reunion. My brother adore Romy and Michelle's high school reunion.
No, part of me feels I'm not the demographic for it, but also I feel that I am. And I saw it at the cinema with my sister and her husband. Right. And it's one of those films, like Groundhog Day, where I have on multiple formats.
Right.
And sort of, I know it's sort of, it's part of, but that whole sense of reunion. But when I saw it, the last thing I would ever have done is gone back to my school reunion. I didn't feel I was ready to.
Right.
Now, 20 years on, I'm certainly ready, indeed have done already, to go back to my university reunion.
Okay.
But that film was very much a marker of, I can't go where these characters are going. But now I feel that I've almost grown up with Romy and Michelle.
Yeah.
And still, although I haven't quite got to the point where I have to say to people, I invented Post-its.
My brother loved that one. Yes, and the other one, what is it? Did you become a famous news anchor? No, I'm a weather girl.
Well, there we are. Well, I know what I'll be watching tonight. But what inspired you then, Mark, to enter academia?
Well, I think it was a weird thing, because saying, despite that kind of revering of education, there was no real knowledge about going to university. And I was coming to the end of my A-levels, and various of my teachers were saying, you know, you really should apply. And it was something where there was no point of reference at home. That's what, you know, other kids, particularly ones that we would have thought of in that kind of Alan Bennett-y way, as definitely more middle class from us, from that kind of trajectory. I don't know. I honestly don't know. Should I be doing this? I was thinking my parents kind of again, not in any kind of nasty dictatorial way, but have led me to believe that you get an education in order to get a good job. And so should I be thinking about a job, you know, now? This is age 17 and a half. And so I ignored the gentle, very friendly pressure from school to fill in, as it was then, PCAS and UCA forms, and went off and thought that I'd got the best thing ever, because I got a job at English Heritage's then UK headquarters, Savile Row, London. So I was going to be going into London, you know, on the tube every day, something that I thought, you know, was also like part of my life, but I also thought was fascinating, you know, the idea that I'd be in Savile Row, I'd be in the West End now. And I went and got this administrative assistant, you know, lowest ranking job, and I was working with a lovely bunch of people who were sort of there to support the conservation archaeologists, and they were all doing fascinating stuff, and I realised very quickly I was doing boring crap stuff. It was really dull. I mean, someone has to do it, but it was very, very dull. And there would often be the fun, shall I say, the fun side of the archaeologists would suddenly realise that some farmer was about to plough up some important site tomorrow, and it was my job, they would dump it on me, my job to ring him up and say, whatever you do, don't do it, because it'd be legally bad for you. And you can imagine what it is, trying to tell a farmer not to plough something. I could hold the phone, you know, as this diatribe was delivered to me, and there I was, 18, and I'm really scared of doing these things. But then I thought, no, I've got to fight about going to university, because I suppose what I thought somehow was that my history interests would be harnessed in the way, working for English Heritage, that's why it seemed so glamorous and exciting. And I could see there were lots of glamorous and exciting jobs going on. And I quickly learned that the only way the glamorous and exciting stuff can happen is if there are lots of really good people that do the fairly dull admin stuff. But that's not for me. So I applied to go to university. And
read history, I'm assuming.
Exactly, read history. And was very I went to Queen Mary. It was partly because aged 17, I'd come down with Crohn's disease really, really badly. And I could barely stand up by the age of 18. And the idea of going away from home when I was taking such a weird mix of medication and only just sort of been stabilised in a hospital, you know, and trying to meet new doctors, that was too much for me. And also I kind of felt, I suppose I also justified to myself, having been to work for a year, I'd completely broken out of school. I'd worked with a lot of people much older than me that had kind of awed me and scared the life out of me, the way they acted in pubs, the way they acted with the opposite sex. I couldn't quite believe that. You know, there was a kind of confidence. I had a very good line manager who was, shall we say, quite good at being a ladies man, and the way he would just say a few things to women in pubs, you know, in the West End on a Friday night, and there I'd be sort of sipping a Perrier. I said, wow, this is the adult world, and I have led such a sheltered life. And I think having kind of done some of that made me think I could actually stay at home at university, because I've done some of the breakings away, you know, have happened. I think had things been slightly different on the health front, maybe I'd have taken some different decisions.
Yeah, and it's interesting, isn't it, how all sorts of challenges or adversities really then define you, but it can also then make you into a much stronger person having done that. I mean, one of the great things about being the senior tutor here is the way that sometimes somebody will come quite broken and, you know, demoralized, thinking, will I get through the degree? Yeah. But then you say, well, actually, this is you know, we're not gonna not let you get your degree because of this, and we will ensure they get through and they become, you know, much stronger for it. But that sounds really inspiring. What about teachers who inspired you?
Oh, well, I mean, I'm still in touch with my old O and A level history teacher, and he, after I left my school, he went up to a school in Leicestershire, and I regularly go up there to give talks, and it's always the weirdest of occasions for me. I love him, and I'm, you know, he was a huge inspiration to me. He could see that I had this interest in history, and he was determined, you know, to stoke it up further in me. And so he was hugely inspirational. And in fact, an old teacher of mine, who was another great inspiration, has just contacted me earlier in the year, which was my RS teacher. I was one of the weird people that did O and A level RS. And it was just me. I was the only person doing O level RE, and I think there was two of us, maybe three of us, doing A-level RE. So it was very good old-fashioned, almost like university levels tutoring that we had. He was hugely inspirational as well, partly because he had a right sense of humour about it all. Was very good at making jokes. It shocked me about every element of the Old and New Testament, but then keeping me going. And so two very fine history teachers, but one in particular I'm still in touch with, and I remember them, and some very good English teachers as well. I remember a mad, very eccentric Welsh geography teacher who was just superb value for inadvertent comedy. I genuinely recall most of my teachers with great affection, my secondary school teachers in particular. And it's lovely to still be in touch with some of them.
And it's wonderful that you're in touch with them, because I always found it very hard sometimes to go back when you've moved on yourself. Yeah. And in some cases now, you know, I'm clearly the age that some of my teachers were when they taught me. And it's very interesting how sometimes there's almost that feeling of regression. It's like I feel I'm 15 over again.
Yeah.
But in some cases, I might have qualifications that they didn't have. Mm. And it's a very strange network. And it's all part of that growing up as we navigate a world. And you see teachers also in a very different light.
Yes.
Of course, because we often think of them disciplining us and being very good. You know, they're obviously skills that, if anything, we don't need to have at university because we don't normally have to be, you know, the cane doesn't normally come out with our university students. But certainly when I was growing up, you know, obviously that was always the ultimate sanction. Very different world. But at university as well, were there any particular lecturers who inspired you?
Absolutely. And I think what was really brilliant, as someone who was actually starting to develop some quite modern history interests, that my the great Jim Bolton, my lecturer in medieval history, he was fantastic, and that inspired me. I did his special subject on 15th century England, even though my real passion was, you know, really starting to be the First World War. That the great Roger Metham, who was a lecturer in early modern history, was an incredibly inspirational and caring lecturer and seminar leader. John Ramsden, who ended up also as my supervisor for my PhD. I have, again, nothing but the most affectionate memories for all of them. And the quality, actually, what really struck me is the sheer degree of patience they had and personal investment in the progression of their students, which sometimes, you know, I look on now, and one of the things that I might even reproach myself for, because the system just seemed less faceless. In my cohort, starting in 1989, I think there were 32 of us on the history, all history programmes at Queen Mary as a first year cohort, and they were saying then, they were complaining that was the biggest they'd ever had, and could they cope with us? Yeah, but of course, what it did mean was some intensely good personal, creative relationships and caring relationships were created that way.
And that was very much my experience with the A level religious studies, because I too was one of the very few people in a church school as well, a church in Wales school, who did. We had to do GCSE religious studies, but A level was optional, and we had a bumper year. The year before us, apparently there were two, and the second person joined very late on in the year, and in our year there may have been six or seven. So we all filled the front row.
Right.
So that was a very unusual experience. But what about extracurricular activities when you were at university?
Right.
Well, anything from politics or sport, religion, what would interest you?
This will show, you know, what a mono-obsessive was. I became head of the History Society, and I loved organising the trips. We didn't do anything particularly grand. In some ways, I suppose, I was building on my own childhood. We liked to find, I persuaded people, that quirky places in London were for us to do. So things like Dr. Johnson's house, the Soane Museum, you know, loved that. Little kind of out-of-the-way places, or doing little walks. We had a very fine lecturer who sort of shadowed history and politics, the great Bill Fishman, who was an expert in late Victorian East End, and he would often take us on walks. We'd ask him to do, you know, walks of around Whitechapel and such like, and obviously we'd end up talking about Jack the Ripper and things like that. But organising that kind of stuff was my crucial thing. Because I was so into football, and I had been properly, you know, converted to West Ham, I'd go to that was, I suppose, the big extracurricular thing. And I had, but outside of anything formally organised by the university, and I had two very close chums, and we still are today. You know, we got together as undergrads, and we did an immense amount of weekend stuff. Actually, even just tramping around, even if it was, you know, from something like to walk from one end of Hyde Park to Tottenham Court Road and just chatting to each other whilst kind of clocking the architecture of London and just chewing the fat, and often, of course, by that stage, repeating Mary Whitehouse Experience Radio 1 sketches to each other, Victor Lewis Smith sketches. We'd become very student Grant, I'm afraid, doing all that stuff from Viz. Lots of Viz, lots of early Viz, repeating Fanar, so a lot of that would be going on. So I spent a lot of time with some really close chums, actually.
And I have to ask you then about radio.
Yes.
Because radio. It sounds like, I mean, yeah. I utterly grew up on Radio 1 in the 80s, and then migrated. How mature was I? At university, I moved to Radio 2, I haven't quite left, although I still have this nostalgia, this hankering for Radio 2 as it was back then, in the Francis Lyne days. But you mentioned Victor Lewis Smith, but what were you listening to around that
radio
period?
Well, from my tiniest years, radio was really important to me, because Radio 2 was very important, because it was before Radio 5, obviously, where you got the football on a Saturday afternoon, and you got a comedy show on radio, often at Saturday lunchtime, the news headlines. I love the fact that 4Extra is repeating the news headlines. I adore Roy Hudd, and it was discovering him on radio, you know, and the Grumbleweed, you know, knockabout acts like that. And sometimes they would either be repeated on a Sunday morning on Radio 2. I remember there was a Bernie Clifton show that I was heavily into. Ken Dodd. A lot of my comedy knowledge, actually, and sort of affections, started with hearing these as radio acts. by the early 80s, I'd become obsessed, again, always on Radio 2, I think it was, or perhaps it was Radio 4 Saturday lunchtime, so it would be repeated late on a Saturday evening. Radioactive, I used to love that series, I thought that was very funny. And then sort of later into my teens, knowing Radio 4, I think it was either 10 o'clock or maybe even 11 o'clock on a Saturday night, I had a comedy half hour, listening to things like The Great Lenin of the Rovers, the gripping story of Britain's only Marxist football club. I mean, that I thought was hilarious with Alexei Sale. The Comedy Upstairs, which came from the Comedy Club with Clive Anderson. Saturday Night Fish Fry, when Stephen Fry must have just left university, you know, with Hugh Laurie and Tony Slattery and people like that. So yeah, comedy on radio and growing up with comedy on radio was hugely I link them axiomatically.
And do you remember Adrian Just on yes. Radio 1 who yeah, used yeah. to blend comedy with music?
Yes.
And that was actually kind of ahead of its time because he was really integrating the jokes with the music and then he'd be offering a commentary on that.
Yeah, yeah.
But that was, you know, Saturday lunchtime, so that went on until Radio 1 moved in different directions in the mid-90s.
Yeah, yeah.
But was it sort of music-based radio or also perhaps Radio 4 that was a particular...
My parents, or certainly my mum, because my dad, you're working nights on the cabs. Mornings was the time it was me, my brother and my mum, you know, except, and then in the holidays, you know, dad would surface around about 10:30, 11-ish in the morning. But she was a huge listener to the Today programme. So what will take me back is order, yesterday in Parliament. That was crucial to me. I suppose in my little bit of teenage rebellion, wanting to do something else, I remember in my early days at secondary school, I discovered Bob Holness and who was it? I'm just wondering, something Cameron on LBC. They had I discovered LBC as this kind of speech station, and I liked their AM program. And again, you know, the adverts. I can remember there was always one from Harrods. There was a little jingle, your early morning call from Harrods. Nessun Dorma. See, I was first exposed to as an advert for Alitalia. On LBC, brava Alitalia, I would say at the end. You know, and so again, the music, the jingles of adverts on LBC, which I listened to a lot as in my early teens.
I used to record all the jingles off Radio 1. I used to get up at 5 to 6, I didn't get up at 5 to 6, but I used to sneakily start my press the play and record button. Hopefully, my parents wouldn't hear me and record all the 5 minutes of uninterrupted jingles before Mark and Liz's breakfast show on a weekend.
And of course, even though I was never a huge listener to the Steve Wright Show, the catchphrases, you know, what was it? The one about, I'm now trying to remember it, thank you very much, Doctor.
And Mr. Angry.
Yeah, Mr. Angry, all of those. And those little little snippets that they would chuck in, I think, champagne. I was first exposed to as a phrase from Radio 1. And then that slow thing, I suppose, that we all started to do by the late 80s, early 90s, of starting to realise that there were old farts out there of the old brigade who were being shoved onto Radio 2 or something. And I always remember a great Harry Enfield sketch, you know, where about getting rid of Smashy and Nicey, who were representative of that generation that I'd grown up with, and you know, allegedly Simon Mayo was a revolution in radio broadcasting.
But what struck me as deeply ironic is that with certainly by the mid-90s, a lot of those former Radio 1, indeed breakfast shows like Steve Wright, were now safely ensconced in the world of Radio 2.
Indeed.
Where, of course, Steve Wright's been doing the afternoon show for nearly 20 years, which, of course, he was doing for many years on Radio 1.
Indeed. And as a chum of mine, you know, this big chum that I met at university, he says, I swear they're not new shows, Mark. They're just repeating the stuff they were playing in 1984. You know, he's at home in bed eating his tins of Quality Street or whatever he wants to do, and they're just playing shows from 30-odd years earlier.
Yeah, it's funny because I was talking to a friend yesterday about how neither of us remember life before Margaret Thatcher, because we were, you know, very much Thatcher's children in that regard. But it's also the same with radio. We all grew up with Steve Wright when we were at primary and secondary school. Now we're listening to the same programme as grown-ups, but it's exactly the same programme. I mean, there's virtually no change in the format.
Indeed. Well, and also, of course, like us all, being a person of a certain age, Sunday mornings will make me misty-eyed for Desmond Carrington from my home in Scotland. Dear Desmond Carrington.
And I followed Desmond Carrington right through to the end. And it was actually sad because I knew he had Alzheimer's. Right. But whether he'd recorded a batch of programmes before he sadly passed away, because there was only a couple of months between his last programme and then the news of his death. But right to the end, on a Friday evening, of course, he was shunted around the schedule. But that was a real glimpse into the golden age of radio.
Absolutely.
And then, of course, you had his death, Brian Matthews' death. And Ed Stewart died a few years ago. But a lot of those radio greats died within a very short period. Jimmy Young, another one. And, of course, Wogan. And that really feels like the end of an era, because those are the people I didn't just grow up to. They were the soundtrack to my life, to my growing up.
Yes.
And that almost feels like a new generation has come in. And in some respects, I perhaps don't feel it has quite the same sort of authenticity.
Yeah, yeah, the sounds of the 60s. And of course, he was, wasn't he? By the time I was an undergrad, we were all doing our Alan Fluff Freeman ironic impressions. All right, right, not half. You know, that was iconic. That was something that I remember. Yeah. I mean, particularly because my my mum's stepfather and her mother had a child quite late on. So my aunt is actually quite close to me. So she was almost like she was almost like an elder sister. And I always associate Fluff Freeman she was obsessed with young Jimmy Osman. I'm a long-haired lover from Liverpool. And I can't get the two of them out of my head, really, because that's what always seemed to be on the countdown to the charts from my earliest memories. You know, would be Freeman doing it and hearing a long-haired lover from Liverpool on Radio 2. Was it on a Sunday afternoon or was it Radio 1 Sunday afternoon?
Fluff came back to Radio 1 in 1989.
Right,
and he continued with that programme for 3 years. But then in 97, I think it was, migrated to afternoon on Radio 2. But you're absolutely right, that whole soundtrack. And for me, even to this day, that would be my dream job, doing Pick of the Pops on a Saturday.
With his jingle, you have to have that, don't you?
Well, when we run our Christmas parties I always do, whether it's running down people, everyone votes for their favourite Christmas song or Christmas, but of course that has to play, I have to do it live.
Yes,
And I have to do it, you know, and I have to, and people are probably sort of thinking, Chris really clearly has issues. But no, it's like, that's true. But this is in my DNA. But if I can't do it at Christmas, but secretly when I'm in the car, I'm counting down myself.
Yeah,
there we are.
Yeah, yeah. You've got the floral dance in at number 8.
Oh, absolutely. Oh,
Captain Beaky.
Oh, absolutely. Well, don't get me started on Junior Choice. It would be a sort of, it would be, you know, for me, the dream job would be Christmas morning when they said, you know, nobody wants to do it live. Yeah. And I'd say, you know, I would, admittedly, it might mean putting, you know, my family may have issues about whether I would be available on Christmas Day. But no, after the thought of a double bill of Junior Choice and Pick of the Pops.
Yeah.
But that's never left me. And I think we talk about the music that we grew up with, but it's very much the music as played on the radio. It was in the charts. It was very much presented by somebody who introduced it. It was the excitement of having a presenter. So a world of CDs doesn't really interest me. Vinyl does, actually.
Yeah, yeah.
But there has to be some sort of continuity. There has to be a link and there has to be a person there.
Yeah.
So I think radio for me is inextricably connected to the sounds with which I grew up.
Yes, and as you say, and cassettes, taping things. Could you become a genius with a pause button and getting there just at the right moment? And so you could almost make your seamless segues from one to another. Yeah. Oh, I remember many a Sunday afternoon. They all seem to be wet in my memory, pouring. They always seem to be midwinter. Not, you know, jolly enough to be in the run-up to Christmas. They're probably, it's like a February when you're in the middle of nowhere zone. You know, it doesn't look like spring yet. And to be sitting there on a dark Sunday afternoon with a BASF cassette in, ready to go to tape the ones that I wanted.
The C90s or the C60s.
And then it would all go watery up because you'd played it so often. Yeah. And particularly the start and the end of the spools, everything sounded like it'd been played underwater. And then when I thought I was very sophisticated in my late teens, saving up some more money so I could buy metal cassettes, those big, much heavier ones, and getting, when I thought I was a real sophisticated sound engineer, a tape head cleaning kit.
it, so I could, you know, get rid of the oxide on and clean the capstan and such like. Crikey, I thought I was only a little spit and a cough away from being a sound engineer then. I really did.
Well, Mark, do you know, I suddenly now feel normal.
It wasn't just me. I was the atypical. I was the weirdo in school.
But no, actually, it clearly was very generational.
My brother, who has done, he's, say, 2.5 years younger than me, but seems to have used eBay solely to rebuild his teen years. Last week when I caught up with him, he bought out, we both sat there, it was like an icon, we just stared at it. He put it on the table, a Sony waterproof Walkman, that one they bought out with like a big plastic clip. It's big, it's yellow, so it looks like, you know, some sort of deep sea diver could use it. He said, got this on eBay, 20 quid. Look, put it on the table. And we both almost genuflected at it. Beautiful, isn't it? Yeah. Absolutely gorgeous thing. So he was happily sourcing himself some pair of genuine, it must have been again from eBay or some specialist supply, some genuine pair of 80s headphones with the yellow foams that would go with it. So that's a fascinating phenomenon, how we can relive some of this through eBay and specialist suppliers these days that we can find on the web.
I'm very sure my children will have a very impoverished experience. Yes, compared exactly. to that. There's no match for what we had in the 80s and 90s. But a few philosophical questions to finish off. Would you say that your memories are predominantly positive ones?
Yes, I suppose in some ways, and I can't work out whether it's how much of a false memory it is. I have a sense, not in my own family life about us as a family, but some of my early memories are of a wider sense of doom and gloom, of Britain in the 70s being a land that had hit rock bottom. You know, I do remember that winter of discontent. I remember being shipped out of school early because we knew power cuts were coming, you know, on winter nights, and my mum would pick us up early, and then we could do only a tiny bit of playing out, as you were allowed to do then, and then she'd be calling us in because even the street lights weren't going on. And I sort of remember amongst my grandparents, you know, a sense of doom and gloom, that you know, just how much lower could the country get. That was very much a part of the one, but nothing to do with our family life. That was always very jolly, but a sense that out there there'd be dragons somehow. And then certainly through my teen years, you know, and once again I find myself thinking that teen years are wasted on teenagers, aren't they? I mean, they were fun at the time, but by crikey, would I like to do them all over again? I'll make sure they'll be even more fun. And my undergraduate years were certainly an absolute blast from start to finish. So yes,
because although I stayed in the same university for 10 years, I pretty much did. Those 3 years as an undergraduate, I can almost demarcate, you know, rather than see it as one big blur, like I was in the same place for 10 years, in terms of the people I was around, in terms of the growing up I did, the skills I learned, particularly as an undergraduate, in terms of assimilating sources and working to deadlines, that has really stayed with me. And to the point that actually it has completely moulded me. But even the things that I'm doing now, even the research I'm doing now, I follow the same template that I acquired, almost it feels by accident, you know, in the sense that I went from not knowing how to write an essay to writing not just an essay, but essays that were getting good marks. And I suddenly thought, oh, I knew nothing about the disestablishment of the church in Wales last week, but now I feel I've read enough sources to feel that I can at least muster something. And then sort of come away feeling, if not an expert, at least somebody who has a contribution to make. And I think that that's always my default position.
Right.
I could do that then. So, you know, there's nothing that's completely impossible if you apply yourself to it.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
What about the question of whether it's possible to be nostalgic about negative experiences? You've touched on that already.
Yeah. I suppose you can be. I mean, I look back, having had Crohn's, you know, still with it now, it's a chronic complaint, you don't get rid of it, that sometimes I feel that perhaps not so much nostalgic, but the lessons it did teach me about how you cope with certain things. And I'm not saying I'm entirely robust about everything, because I'm not. Perhaps that taught me something where I'm nostalgic about it. I don't think I am there. I think I'm probably, like a lot of us, nostalgic for the teen misery moments where the Smiths albums were going, you know, playing the kind of Pretty in Pink cliches. Please, 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 let me get what I want this time. You know, being the ducky of the thing. That I always wanted Molly Ringwald to be my girlfriend, you know, and I knew it wasn't going to be like the end of Pretty in Pink for me, you know. Yeah, but that sense of, I suppose I have a nostalgia of wallowing in that solipsistic moments of teenage misery. I was never generally like that. You know, I was actually quite... my parents would say I was never a totally miserable teenager, but would have moments of it. And I do have a kind of weird nostalgia for that moment of, in fact, a completely, shall we say, carefree and responsibility-free melancholia that I was allowed to enjoy and wallow in, and pull jumpers down to my knuckles and do things like that.
Because what those films did really well was to show that it was, and Romeo and Michelle, I guess, did the same thing a decade later, was to show that it's okay to be different. It's okay to be more of a nerd than to be one of the A-list people. And in doing that, these films gave us the hope that actually we could define ourselves but be proud of who we were with integrity.
Absolutely.
And in that sense, even if you didn't always fit in at school, even if there were things that you didn't perhaps... I was never a sports person. Right. And often it was the people who did sports who were the ones who went on to be head boy or head girl. And, you know, I was never in that sort of category. Mm. But there were things that I did and I could say, well, but this is really what I'm about. And I could be validated by those films, or maybe not the films because I didn't watch them, but the music certainly is that period.
Absolutely, yeah. And nothing did it like the Smiths. And then this is sort of drifting away of can you be nostalgic about sad memories? I mean, or sort of trials or whatever. The other end of the Smiths for me, I was always a big Madonna fan. Yeah, and just the sheer daft joy in much of that, really, and the fact that it did seem quite rebellious for a young woman, even in a world that had allegedly, you know, been through a more shall we say promiscuous age, or so it was presented of the 60s and 70s, still what she seemed to be doing seemed remarkably raunchy, sexy out there. And she had a confidence, I could see that, even, you know, age 13-14 or whatever it was.
And I remember when the 6 o'clock news, I even remember Nicholas Witchell reading the news, and it was when she got married to Sean Penn. Oh, would have been around the time of Into the Groove, Desperately Seeking Susan, and that was one of the stories on the main evening news. So that showed that she, you know, and of course it was playing on the whole the material girl is getting married.
Yes.
But you're right, that there was something very defining about that era. Mm. And although I was too young at the time, because I was 12 when Desperately Seeking Susan came out, through the Into the Groove music video, I really wanted to explore that. It was a sense of really coming of age maturity. Mm. It was a real sense that this was something a little bit naughty and a little bit different.
Yeah.
But it just about chimed with where I was in terms of adolescence.
Yeah, and then to go from that to the daftness of Ghostbusters, which I remember very well, I loved. And then Shanghai Surprise, well, at least said soonest mended about Madonna's performance.
Yeah, yet to watch that one.
Oh, yeah. You can leave that again. Yeah. That's what happens, I think, when you were 14 or 15, whenever that one came out, you had to go and see it. I thought, what am I doing here? Yeah. Even then, I thought, this is nonsense. Absolute rubbish. Yeah.
Would you say that you fulfilled the dreams you had when you were young? I mean, do you ever entertain thoughts about doing something different with your life? Maybe in keeping with something you dreamt about doing as a child or at university?
Right. I suppose in some ways I have, because I one of the things that I really wanted to do, I think around about the age of 14-15, because of that love of history, because of that love of London, I thought it'd be brilliant to be a tour guide, to take people on walks, you know, and could I inspire them, you know, could I share something that they would find equally fascinating and exciting? That really excited me, that idea, because I just thought it was a natural default if everyone was interested in history. I really did. That's how kind of solipsistic I was. I couldn't believe that there wouldn't be people out there that wouldn't be interested of where the Great Fire started and ended. You know, it just wouldn't compute. So the idea of sort of going round with like-minded people and perhaps adding a little bit to their knowledge seemed like the best of all jobs I could get. And obviously I didn't quite go that route, but in some ways that is what I do now. You know, when I take my students on battlefield tours or stuff like that, I march them around. I march them between places and some of them look as if they're enjoying it. Yeah. But so I don't think that I would
you know, if you could go back and engineer things differently. I don't know, I engineered them that differently.
Because and the same with me, in the sense that I've never lost that hankering to do something on the radio, but somehow the way that I teach is very much, I sometimes feel that when I'm teaching the students, it's almost like I'm sort of channeling some of the great theologians, but also Ed Stewart. The only thing missing is the accumulator quiz and the traffic with Sally Bowes. Yeah. But two more questions. Are you in touch with friends from your past?
As I said, big chums, the two big chums that I made at university, we still regular contact. One of them is godparent, one of my kids. They were both ushers at a wedding. It was only the fact that I'd long ago had a pact with my brother that we'd be each other's best man that sort of kept me on that, because otherwise would have definitely asked both of them to perform that function. I'm in touch with one old school friend that I still keep up with, and that's about it on that front, really. I suppose when you do our game, what happens is, of course, a lot of people, particularly that I remember as PhD students, I started to go to conferences, you know, or seminars. So there's a gang of us who are all about the same study stage and all starting to jump the same hurdles. And even if they're not quite in my, you know, neck of the discipline, I'll bump into them because we're bound to meet at certain kind of communal watering holes, as it were, whether it be the British Library or something like that, and we'll always have a little chat. But in terms of you're actively cultivating relationships, it's a fairly small number, but it's very intimate, it's very intense and great because of that.
Yeah. And are you a looking back or a looking forward kind of person?
A terrible looking back. And actually, in fact, that might be the single biggest problem that this has given me. I find, and I think my family are all like it, my brothers certainly like it, and particularly at this time of year. I mean, we all know Christmas seems to do it anyway. But, and as I think I said to you, Chris, you know, having done that thing through eBay of buying up all of the Christmas and TV radio times, you know, heaven forbid, I'm confessing this now. You know, I think it's from 1978 to something like 1996 I've got them. And my brother will love me to do a quick call. You know, what was on BBC One Christmas Day 1985? And then we will both start reeling off the presents that we got, you know, the family argument that took off, that who spilt what at the table, mum running around trying to mop up a glass of port or something that had gone all over the new carpet. You know, it all pour out, and we can nail it right down.
And is that from memory?
Yes.
Not just from lists?
No.
So just looking at those TV and radio listenings?
It'll do it, bang. And he's in some ways worse than I am about that. And yes, at times I find it fun. At other times I think I do find it a little bit of a curse.
But when the BBC brought in their genome site so you can see all the old listings from Radio Times, what a wonderful repository that
absolutely.
Was.
Yeah.
And a memory bank, and also filled in the gaps in my old diaries from when I was a child.
Yeah, and of course, adverts in those TV times do it as well. You know, when you see the kind of electronic kit that Currys or Tandy's were trying to knock out for you, and looking at the relative costs of it, and also is a fascinating thing. Yeah, so a lot of the time it is good fun, but sometimes I do think I spend a lot of my time... Was it Evelyn Waugh who wrongly, but rather beautifully, said in *Brideshead Revisited*, "We possess nothing certainly except the past," and that's the way I feel about it.
On that very erudite note, Mark Connolly, it's been such a pleasure to catch up. Thank you very much.
Thank you for asking me, Chris. It's been great.